Thank you. That was wonderful, and it is wonderful to be here. Well, I can tell that the Independent Institute is probably not on Attorney General Ashcroft's speaking tour. It doesn't seem to be one of the stops. Let's see. Can you see me? I'm short. So, no, we can't see you. This is always my problem. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to have an opportunity. Give me a soapbox or a shorter lectern. Good evening. I have to say that I wasn't very familiar with the Independent Institute before the last couple of months, and I feel tremendously reassured, actually, to be part of this program, and I felt quite upbeat driving over here tonight, even given the topic of the forum, because I realized that there is, exemplified, I think, in the Patriot Act debate and reaction, a real truth about a nonpartisan, non-political in terms of political parties, commitment to liberty and commitment to equality that is reflected in the kind of turnout we have tonight. And that is tremendously reassuring because we do need that voice in this day and age. About a week ago, I got a telephone call from a former student of mine at Santa Clara, and he was very concerned, left a couple of voicemail messages. I called him back, and it turned out that he had been contacted by the FBI here in Oakland, and all that they would tell him was that they wanted to talk to him, that he shouldn't worry. The agent said, you don't need to flee the country or anything. You are not suspected of anything, but we just want to ask you a couple of questions. We're doing an investigation. So needless to say, he was very concerned. He is a United States citizen of Iranian descent. He was on the eve of studying to take the professional responsibility exam, which is part of the examination process that law school graduates go through before they can be sworn into the bar, the California bar, among others. And he just repeated over and over how concerned he was, despite the fact that he could think of nothing that he had done that was wrong. He could think of nothing that anyone he knew had done was wrong. But he remembered from having taken my constitutional law class that there might be a problem here. And so he called to ask for some advice and, about how he should answer these requests. And what also bothered him about these requests is that, at least superficially, they were very informal. Right, the FBI agent said, would you like to meet with us in a coffee shop? We can come by your house some evening. And never anything formal, no office, no suggestion that it was a formal meeting. So I tell that story really as an example of what the USA Patriot Act and other post-September 11th responses have created in this country, which I think is truly a climate of fear. And although the student who called me is a person of color, is not an immigrant, but the son of immigrants, his story really resonates with many people who do not fall into those categories. The sense of fear that is experienced when you get the call that suggests that you've done something wrong, but you don't know what it is, and perhaps the only thing that you've done wrong is to associate with other people. As I said, his story was certainly special, but not unique. It has been experienced by many, many people, particularly, as David Cole pointed out, particularly immigrants, particularly non-citizens, particularly people of color. And this student is actually relatively fortunate in that he's studying to become a lawyer. He spent at least 28 weeks studying constitutional law, and he knows his rights to a certain extent. But many of the people who have been detained, who have been questioned post-September 11th, actually have very little or no exposure with the law. They don't know lawyers, they can't afford lawyers, they don't know the Constitution. And so they really turn to us, the rest of us, I think, people like us, for a sense of reassurance and understanding that the Constitution means something in this country. Now, even if you're a lawyer, even if you know lawyers, right, you know that lawyers can't solve very many problems, but particularly when a law is the source of a problem, and the USA Patriot Act is an example, certainly, of such a law. So I thought what I would talk to you about in this short period of time is a current challenge that has been filed by the ACLU, the national office, against the USA Patriot Act and then to talk about some other work that's been done on a legislative and local organizing level to resist the USA Patriot Act, and especially the Patriot Act II, the Domestic Security Enhancement Act. The lawsuit was filed in Michigan in July of this year, and I don't know how many people are familiar with it, but basically a group of about six organizations in Michigan filed suit in federal court challenging one particular provision, Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act. The organizations that filed the suit include, let me just read them off, the Muslim Community Association of Ann Arbor, which operates a mosque and school in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, a national civil rights organization based in Washington, D.C., the Arab American Center for Economic and Social Services, a human services organization in Dearborn, Michigan, that operates a medical clinic and other services for refugees, the Bridge Refugee and Sponsorship Services based in Knoxville, Tennessee, with offices in Michigan, the Council for American Islamic Relations, which is a national organization also that has a grassroots membership in Michigan, and the Islamic Center of Portland, Oregon, which operates a mosque and is based in Portland, Oregon, and also has a connection to Michigan. These are the organizations. They represent individuals who have been affected in ways post-September 11th that clearly reflect the application of the USA Patriot Act in a way that targets them, in part based on race, ethnicity, citizenship status, and particularly freedom of speech and association, the activities that they have been engaged in. And the challenge is under the First Amendment as well as the Fourth and Fifth Amendments to Section 215, which allows the FBI in a very broad way to obtain records and other, quote, tangible things of people, even if they're not suspected of criminal activity, whether they're citizen or non-citizen, and that these records can include papers, documents, files, obviously, anything else, and anything, as long as the FBI certifies to a FISA judge, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act judge, that they are seeking this information as part of an ongoing foreign intelligence, counterintelligence, or international terrorism investigation. Now, what's so significant about this section is that it relaxes, and I would argue even eliminates completely, any sense of duty and obligation for the FBI to certify, to obtain a Section 215 order based on something even resembling probable cause. A relevant provision of the FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, referred to the need to show specific articulable facts that would give a reason for the FBI to obtain such an order. This has no such requirement. In addition, under Section 215, these kinds of orders to search, to seize, can be conducted in complete secrecy, with no obligation to inform the target of the investigation ever that they are the target of the investigation, and a mandate that anyone who is served with a 215 order, such as a bookstore owner, a librarian, etc., a mandate that they not disclose ever that they have been served with such an order. This applies to, as I mentioned, to citizens and non-citizens, although you can imagine who are going to be targeted the most. And Section 215, I think, has some obvious implications that are very clear on the face of it and is being challenged on its face under the First Amendment. But what I think it also reflects is something that our other speakers have written about and talked about, which is this presumption that the government, that the Attorney General's office, the FBI and the CIA, not have to demonstrate a reason under the Constitution for gathering the information that they are trying to gather. In some of the, I guess I would call myths that have been spoken by Attorney General Ashcroft on his speaking tour in defense of Patriot Acts 1 and 2, he has actually said, oh, well, you know, the act, it doesn't necessarily apply to citizens, so don't worry about it, right? And the act talks about persons, U.S. persons, meaning persons in the United States. Moreover, he says, Well, you should really trust that this will not be abused, because if the FBI says it is seeking this information for an ongoing investigation, that's really enough. But the presumption in the statute is that if the FBI says it, it is deemed to be so, and that that should be accepted by the judge, which exactly reverses the presumption that constitutionally you are supposed to create and respect. Now, what does this create for all of us? I can identify many problems. There are lots of problems of inequality and due process. I want to focus on how this affects our freedom of expression. And I do mean all of us, no matter how protected or unprotected you think you are with respect to the current climate. Even if you do not tend toward paranoia, wouldn't it concern you to think that this order actually extends to gather information about the books you read, about your subscription habits, right? About any other records, medical records, banking records, economic, anything that is deemed to be relevant to an ongoing investigation that not necessarily focuses on you, but on someone that you know, right? Now, it may be the case that the student who called me is being questioned subject to a Section 215 order, and that information is being gathered about him, even though, as he says, I haven't done anything wrong. I can't even imagine why they would even be contacting me. A year ago, that is fall semester 2002, I taught a seminar on civil liberties problems post 9/11. And just to give you an example of how this chilling effect actually operates in fact, I ordered a number of books for the seminar, including David Cole's previous book on terrorism and the Constitution, and I don't think your book was out yet, but of course it would have been assigned. And I remember just going up to the cash register at my local megastore with a huge stack of books about terrorism by Alan Dershowitz and David Cole and Barbara Olshansky, and I just was so proud of myself. Great professor, I had a big stack of books. And I got to the counter, and all of a sudden I saw myself through someone else's eyes. And chilling effect, it greatly concerned me. During the course of the semester, a couple of students told me that they were a little leery of getting on public transportation with David Cole's book because it has terrorism right on the front, right? What are they doing reading about that? Especially the students of color felt that way. So, I think that this First Amendment challenge is a very important one. The status of the case is that there has been a motion to dismiss based on the argument that these organizations really haven't demonstrated that they have suffered the injury or that their members have suffered the injury to give them standing actually to challenge it. In the meantime, there are other attempts to get rid of Patriot Act and to forestall Patriot Act II. So let me just mention two in which the ACLU and many other organizations are involved, and then close. The first is called the SAFE Act, standing for Security and Freedom Ensured, sort of borrowing from the acronym creativity of the USA Patriot Act itself. And this was introduced in October of this year, October 2nd, by a bipartisan group of senators, and it's a bill to amend the USA Patriot Act to place reasonable limitations on the use of surveillance, the issuance of search warrants for other purposes. Its short title is called the Security and Freedom Ensured Act of 2003, and the purpose of it is basically to focus on some of the key provisions that have really garnered the most criticism, some of which have been mentioned, the roving wiretap provision, the search warrant provision, the lack of any kind of probable cause standard before records and other papers can be gathered, and to move this along so that perhaps there will be some kind of legislative change, even if the lawsuit is not successful or even if the lawsuit does not reach resolution anytime soon. Next, on the local grassroots level, I think many of you are probably aware that there have been cities, local governments, that have discussed the merits of passing resolutions against the Patriot Act. And I just want to mention a couple of Northern California communities have done that and explain why that is actually very helpful and why I think it's legitimate. Santa Cruz, Sebastopol, Fairfax, Arcata, San Francisco, Richmond, Cotati, Sonoma, El Cerrito, Los Gatos. I don't see Oakland and Berkeley on the list. But I can't, yes, I certainly they must be on this list. And the overall number in California is actually in the high 100s. Several states as well have passed resolutions. And some people have disparaged this as just basically a waste of time of local resources. But I do want to mention one possibility if you are interested in organizing along these lines or encouraging this in your local community. And it is this. In Mountain View, actually, a couple of months ago, the city asked essentially for a policy report to be presented about why cities should even take a position on the USA Patriot Act. What impact does it have on the city? And a colleague of mine, a professor at Stanford named Tino Cuellar, worked on really a wonderful report that was presented as a policy report that actually went through the local impacts. And also argued, in addition to the impact it would have on law enforcement, et cetera, local resources such as public libraries, argued that there is an independent value in and of itself in obviously protecting the constitutional rights of citizens of a particular community. And that should be considered to be some tangible local impact that has to be recognized. So those are some efforts that I think have really sped things along. Let me close by just mentioning a couple of things about the Act in the larger context of constitutional law that I don't think can be stressed enough. Freedom of speech is certainly important, equality, due process. But even if the USA Patriot Act were repealed tomorrow, even if Patriot II, right, never came down the pike, we would still be in a pretty dire situation with respect to civil liberties in that I think we have now a presumption, right, coming from the current administration, the Attorney General, and others, that meaningful judicial review is something that can really be dispensed with. And the Guantanamo Bay cases that have just been accepted for review in the U.S. Supreme Court are an example of this. In Section 215 of the Act, as I mentioned, there is this sort of assumption that you can just go to the judge, go to the FISA judge, and say you have a reason, and the wand will be waved, and you will have the right to seek. But that really is part of a much larger pattern that seriously threatens checks and balances. The notion that you should trust the executive branch because of the war on terrorism, that these statutes aren't even written to be reviewed by a court, if you really think about it. The vagueness of the language means that they're not intended to be interpreted, and it's because judges are not supposed to have any meaningful role. And then, of course, you have the question of what judges there are once you get to the judiciary, but that's another topic. So I really wanted to end with going back to first principles, James Madison's notion of courts being this impenetrable bulwark against the other branches, against overreaching. It sounds like very dramatic language, but it is especially vividly meaningful today. And then to end with a quote from Justice Jackson, more recently, about the purpose of the Bill of Rights, the independence of the Bill of Rights, the fact that they exist and should be enforced by courts independent of the will of the people through legislatures in enacting laws such as the USA Patriot Act. Justice Jackson said, "The very purpose of the Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy, to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials, and to establish them as legal principles to be applied by courts. One's right to life, liberty, and property, to free speech, a free press, freedom of worship and assembly, and other fundamental rights may not be submitted to vote. They depend on the outcome of no elections." So let us hope that even if the Patriot Act and Patriot Act II disappear in the next year or so, that we will continue to be reminded of fundamental freedoms and the role of courts in protecting them. Thank you.
I want to thank David for inviting me out here. It's great to come out to Oakland. You know, there's such a different spirit here than there is in Washington, D.C. And I've only been here for a couple of days, but from my conversations, I think it's safe to conclude that the average taxi driver out here knows more about the Patriot Act than the average member of Congress in Washington. You know, it's just fascinating to be getting a ride in from the airport, and all of a sudden the person starts making these astute comments, well, there's this problem and that problem. And the average congressman, I mean, even some of the good ones, some of the co-sponsors of the ACLU-sponsored act, Senator Craig, he was quoted in the Washington Post a few weeks ago, saying, well, you know, I'm not aware of any victims of the Patriot Act. You know, I mean, these folks, I mean, you know, there are many people who have George Bush's reading habits. That's part of their problem here. So George Bush commented about 6 weeks ago that, you know, that he's careful not to read the papers because he doesn't want to have a biased source of news. And instead of relying on the papers, he just talks to Condi Rice and Andrew Card, his chief of staff. So, and Bush said, you know, Bush said that those two sources were objective, you know, and Bush could trust them. So it's rather amusing. John Ashcroft, in his recent Patriot Act Salvation Tour, which was one of the biggest PR fiascos in Justice Department history. I mean, it's fascinating that Ashcroft would think that by traveling around the country and speaking only to closed audiences of prosecutors and law enforcement and FBI agents, not allowing any print media to question him, that would somehow spur so much public enthusiasm for the Patriot Act, you know? Instead, it became this a complete farce. And he was hounded a few places by some mainstream press reporters. It was just like, it was funny to see him dodging. It was like he was dodging a subpoena, you know, dodging some of these journalists, you know. But it was probably prudent because he hasn't, you know, if you look at the text of his speech, one of Ashcroft's lines he kept using, he says, America is more secure today than 2 years ago, and it's safer and freer at any time than at any time in the history of human freedom. He keeps stressing the lives and liberties of all Americans are protected by the Patriot Act. And this, you know, it's amazing to see how brazen the Justice Department is on these things. It's almost as if they think that all Americans watch only Fox News. and no one's going to be able to put two and two together on these things. You know, it's interesting how the Bush administration moved so rapidly to capitalize after 9/11 by basically going to the closet of the Justice Department and taking out all these old provisions and bills that Congress had completely rejected when Janet Reno was Attorney General. And even Ashcroft himself, he had a wonderful quotation in 1997. He said, "Americans don't need a big brother to read all their email, to have track of all their medical records, and to know everything that they're doing." I mean, he was very vigilant on privacy before he became Attorney General. But it's fascinating that with the Patriot Act, it was basically the Patriot Act treats every citizen like a suspected terrorist, and every federal agent as a proven angel. George Bush and Ashcroft pulled off the biggest bait and switch in American constitutional history. Instead of targeting terrorists, like Bush and Ashcroft claimed, the Patriot Act extends all these new powers, all these new surveillance and seizure powers, to anyone suspected of violating any of the 3,000 different crimes in the federal statute book. That's why you have the Patriot Act being used in cases of obscenity, on drugs, on white collar, on racketeering. The Patriot Act was recently used to confiscate a telemarketing firm's bank accounts because it was accused of fraud. They didn't have any evidence, and it would have been very difficult to seize those bank accounts with a normal federal prosecution. But the Patriot Act is great because it saves a lot of paperwork, you know, for these federal agents that want to do these searches and do these seizures. The Bush administration converted 9/11 into a trump card against American privacy. And one example of this is carnivore. Back in the summer of 2000, when carnivore is the FBI's email wiretap system, email wiretap software. And the Americans first learned about this in the summer of 2000, and people were horrified to think that Janet Reno and Bill Clinton could have that kind of power to intercept and read everybody's email. And there were some comical elements because it turned out that the reason the FBI used the name carnivore for this wiretapping system was the FBI thought that nobody would ever find out about it. You know, I mean, simple, you know, from a simple PR perspective, you know, the name carnivore, it just doesn't look good in the papers. And but something which the Patriot Act did, the Patriot Act changed the name. It's no longer carnivore. It's now, I think, the DSC 1000 or the DCS 1000. So thank God they've taken care of that problem. But and it's curious how the, you know, it was a longstanding principle in American jurisprudence. It was not always obeyed, but a principle, as Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said, wrote in 1921, Holmes wrote that the use of the males is almost as much a part of free speech as the right to use our tongues. And yet, with this carnivore system that has completely trumped any right to email privacy, with the way the system works, the government can get a warrant to track one person's email. One person, and the FBI goes in, compels their internet service provider to attach this black box to their computer system, and an FBI agent only has to push one button on that carnivore system and can automatically copy all the email of all the customers. I mean, this is sort of like having a search warrant for one house, and you go and you search the house, and you figure, just to be sure, let's search all the houses in a five-mile radius. And Congress was, the Bush administration and Congress were explicitly dishonest in how they sanctified this in the Patriot Act. It was described as if it was a pen register wiretap. And a pen register wiretap is like a very light wiretap where you're only tracing the incoming and outgoing phone numbers. Well, this is not quite what copying all of someone's email is. But the feds went ahead and misrepresented that way, and so far it's... It has not been struck down, even though there has been a lot of concern about how these things are being misused. Something else that they have, you know, there's been so many searches. According to Ashcroft early this year, federal agents have issued over 18,000 counterterrorism subpoenas and search warrants in the last 2 years. In many cases, FBI agents have gone in and snared the information simply through intimidation. There was some controversy over the library searches, and the American Library Association surveyed its members, and almost 10% of them said that they'd been contacted in the months after 9/11 to give out information on their library users. And there were a number of newspaper stories about FBI agents going in and getting this information. But Ashcroft in September said that they've never used this Section 215 to get library records. Well, they're getting them somehow. And one of the ways they're doing it is something called national security letters. A national security letter is an FBI subpoena, which an FBI agent can come in and demand that a person surrender their business records, their email, their phone records, almost any kind of personal records. And it's simply, and there's a the person that receives the subpoena is muzzled for 5 years or muzzled forever to prohibit it from disclosing it. And if the person discloses they received the subpoena, they can get several years in prison. And these are things that are not being counted. We don't know how many of these national security letters have been issued. And there is no judicial control on this. There are parts of the Patriot Act that trample the Fourth Amendment. This is something which is simply pretends it doesn't exist. And this is to have these FBIs at field level office being able to do this. It's a complete mockery. Now, there's a number. Ashcroft has often insisted that we don't need to worry about the Patriot Act violating our civil rights because there are courts. It's controlled by courts. But a lot of it's going through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Now, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court is a secret court. It meets in a closed secret part of the Justice Department headquarters. No one is ever allowed. No non-government employee is ever allowed to go there, and no defense attorney is ever allowed to appear and argue against granting a search warrant. Now, since this court was created in 1978, the FBI has requested 14,000 search warrants. This court's been very consistent. It's given 14,000 search warrants. Even though a couple years ago the court became very aggravated because it turned out that the FBI admitted they had lied and misused a lot of the data from many of these search warrants, and there was a big, you know, big protest. And there was a court decision which walked through some of these abuses by the FBI. Well, Congress never heard about that because Ashcroft's Justice Department said that Congress had no right to see the decision of the secret court about the FBI abuses. And this is the court which is supposed to be protecting our freedom now. But instead, it's usually very servile, and the playing field is completely stacked against the American people here. Now, Patriot Act overturned one of the most important Supreme Court decisions of the last 5 years. Back in 1998, that flaming liberal Clarence Thomas wrote a decision which struck down the Customs Service policy of confiscating all of the cash of people leaving the U.S. who failed to notify the government that they were taking more than $10,000 with them. This was a very arbitrary policy. Thomas, joined by four other justices, said that it was a violation of the excessive fines clause of the Eighth Amendment. This was a landmark decision because it was one of the first times that the Supreme Court recognized that crushing penalties for mere paperwork violations were unconstitutional. As soon as this came down, the Customs Service and the Justice Department started working to get it overturned. And in the Patriot Act, Congress created a new crime called bulk cash smuggling. And by amazing coincidence, this is exactly what the law was, almost exactly what the law was that the Supreme Court struck down. And you've had over 600 people who have had all of their cash taken away from them when they were traveling if they failed to fill out this one little customs form. And it doesn't take any evidence of wrongdoing, because that was the issue in the 1998 case. It was a Syrian American guy flying out of LAX, taking several hundred thousand dollars with him to pay off some family loans. Well, federal district court, federal appellate court, both concluded that the money was honestly acquired. But the Justice Department kept insisting, well, that didn't matter. This person violated the law. Well, it was almost like some kind of modern version of some type of fugitive slave act, that someone's taking their money out of the country. Oh, my God, you know. I'm sure Huckleberry Finn would have a good line on that. And the Customs Service, in their testimony, talks about all these as victories over terrorist financing. You know, there is almost no evidence in the vast majority of these cases of any terrorist link. But what the government does is say, well, there was a Mideast connection to a lot of this money. Well, what that meant was the person whose money was grabbed may have been flying to Cairo, Riyadh, or Tel Aviv. That's the standard of evidence that they're using. And that is how pervasive the dishonest propaganda is here. You know, a lot of people have said that, okay, the Patriot Act has problems, but it's important to make us safe. Well, there was no shortage of federal power before 9/11. The feds had all the clues that they needed, and yet they failed. Yet it was the biggest law enforcement and intelligence failure since Pearl Harbor, and the feds have reaped a huge amount of new power because of this. And talking with people, it's just this whole idea of trading security for freedom. People act like there's some type of some type of altar which the exchange can be made at, or some type of higher being which is going to guarantee us that if we sacrifice our freedom, then abracadabra, we will deserve to be more secure. Well, you know, what the government, in areas where people have sacrificed their freedom since 9/11, the primary effect is it's made it easier for the government to hide its mistakes. There have been a lot of cover-ups. There's been a lot more secrecy. Ashcroft has tried to gut the Freedom of Information Act, and they've done so much stonewalling in the White House. And there's a lot of, Americans have not even seen the tip of the iceberg of post-9/11 abuses. There have been some great stories out, some fascinating stories. One fascinating thing about what David was commenting about, the Roundup, Colleen Rowley, the FBI agent in Minneapolis who blew the whistle on how the headquarters screwed up. She also wrote a letter earlier this year and talked about how FBI agents were under intense pressure to round up more detainees after 9/11 as bragging points for the FBI PR. And there was so much pressure that some of the FBI agents started to just go to telephone books to try to find Arab and Muslim names of people that could be brought in and interrogated. I mean, this is their idea of focusing law enforcement resources. And you know, people, agencies like that that screwed up so massively, giving them more power isn't going to make us safe. I mean, and it's appalling that there's so little interest in Congress in doing good oversight. It's one of the most profound failures of American democracy in post 9/11 that Congress has basically playing ostrich or just kind of taking a dive like some kind of prize fighter diving, taking a dive in the first round. And congressmen are so afraid to even ask questions at these hearings. You have Tom Ridge showing up and acting like a cigar, well, and acting like just, you know, it's amazing to see what these administration officials are getting away with. And there are some good congressmen who have tried very hard, people like Ron Paul and Russ Feingold and Charles Grassley has done some very good work on the FBI. Conyers has done some very good work. But as a group, congressmen have completely defaulted on their oath of office. These people took an oath to uphold the Constitution, and somehow most of them act like 9/11 nullified that oath. And that's a failure of our democracy. People have got to put more pressure on these people. So anyhow, I've rambled on enough, so I'll draw the curtain of mercy.